tower, and a woman young and old, and words for music, perhaps. That's what I mean. And the winding stair. Obviously, there can be no question of dealing even sketchily with all of them. I would like to know from you which of these poems or sections of them you would like us to spend some time with today.
I'm curious why he put All Souls Night at the end of the tower. Since it was written in 19, well, it was written much earlier, I think, 21 or 20. And
yes.
It seems a sort of an unusual way to end that book of poems.
Well, let's see if in fact it does end that way in the collected. Did you check on that?
I think it does, yeah.
All Souls Night. Well, it originally appeared in another form, I think, at the end of a book that we haven't looked at, though we've looked at other things from it, called Inamica Silentia Luna. I do mean that, don't I? I don't mean at the end of a vision, do
you? It is at the end of a vision.
At the end of a vision. Well, that's what I had in mind. At the end of a vision, and that is, you're quite right, well, of course, here it says, it belongs to a vision. And that is, of course, its appropriate place. But just as in other cases he had taken out poems from these mingled prose and poetry works, he took out other poems from A Vision and put them in the appropriate collection, and others from this brief anticipation of A Vision called Inamica Silentia Lunae, which includes, for instance, Ego Dominus Tuus. I think the question might be why All Souls Night should come in the tower, since, as you point out, it was available for earlier collections. I think, well, there are many reasons for this. The tone and mood is, for Yeats at this period, surprisingly subdued and philosophical. It's also the case that, of course, this is set in Oxford. Page 119 is where this poem starts. Midnight has come with the great Christchurch bell, and many a lesser bell sounds through the room, and it is All Souls' Night. Yeats did spend months at a time in a house that he rented outside Oxford, and had a reasonably good company there and was reasonably at home. But this would have muddled the sort of locality and the ideological loyalties of both The Wild Swans at Kew and Michael Robartes and The Dancer, because The Wild Swans at Kew, both of these are very Irish collections. The first of them, it's true, is about the European War, the First Great War, but it is seen from the point of view of an Irishman, Robert Gregory, is the characteristic soldier, who is an Anglo-Irish airman. And Michael Robartes and The Dancer, of course, is very deliberately entirely set in Ireland and in the civil war between the English and the Irish. So I think that might have been another reason why it would have been disconcerting and confusing to admit that, in fact, he very much liked living in the English city of Oxford. And indeed, in one of its most splendid, within sound of one of its splendid colleges. Anything else about that poem? The names that are appear in this poem are less conspicuous names than the ones that we have learned to talk about. That have cropped up already. You will have, I suppose, checked with George Brandon Saul so as to know who Horton is. Horton's the first I call. The beginning of the third stanza. Florence Emery, at the beginning of the fifth. and MacGregor at the beginning of the 7th. These are all interesting people. MacGregor Mathers is a particularly bizarre and in many ways sinister figure with whom Yeats had certain contacts when he, Yeats, and Mathers were particularly active in occult practices in London. Horton is a gentler and probably, I say probably because I'm able to check on these matters, probably more scholarly and less sensational necromantic scholar. Florence Emery is, she figures in Yeats's biography in general as, sometimes under the name of Florence Farr, as a person who assisted him in careful reading of poetry. But here he is concerned with her in her private capacity and her spiritualistic interests too. All Souls' Night is, of course, the night when, by tradition, you, if you go through the proper ritual, you put out the wine glasses at midnight, and if you summon the ghost properly, the ghost comes to drink from the breath of wine. Miss Farr, Florence Emery, as you will have seen from Saul's commentary, migrated to Ceylon to teach there in a school for the Ceylonese and died there of cancer in 1917. And this is referred to. She was already sick when she went. Now, come along, let me have someone else cooperate besides Mr. Sherman. Yes?
I had problems with among school children.
Yes.
Each individual stanza seems all right, but I can't get the way that they follow together, particularly with the last three stanzas.
Yes, well, this now is an important and difficult poem, which we have talked of already. Give us the page.
115.
Well, let's go through it very briefly. I think it would be wrong to read it, though I'm tempted to do so. Yeats is here the senator, the 60-year-old public smiling man, as he says, and he is, as part of his duties as a senator, on a commission to look after Irish education, here in a, of course, Roman Catholic school run by the nuns. Seeing them, the children, and the kind old nun, sets him to think of a Lydian body. I dream of a Lydian body bent above a sinking fire, a tale that she told of a harsh reproof or trivial event that changed some childish day to tragedy. That is, of course, Maud Gonne. Some tale that she told him of her school children, so her, the image of her comes into his mind. Her body is Lydian, and this is related, of course, to Leda and the Swan, a sort of beautiful human body which might tempt a god to generate upon that body a new divine annunciation. The third goes on about that. He looks back at the children and wonders if any of them are like what Maud Gonne was like when she was that age. In four, the way she is now comes into his mind, and this is one of several very, very sensitive portraits of the haggard, still beautiful in bone, but increasingly haggard and gaunt old woman that Maud Gonne has become. Wonderful image. Did quite quattrocento finger passionate hollow of cheek as though it drank the wind and took a mess of shadows for its meat. which may remind us of how in Ego Dominus Tuus Dante was called hollow of cheek too, and this figures with quattrocento. Late medieval Italy is pretty consistently the place and the period that Yeats invokes whenever he goes outside Ireland for his image of both the works of human beings and the personalities of human beings, I mean, of the elites, are brought to their highest pitch. Five is the passage which I referred to earlier. What youthful mother, a shape upon her lap, honey of generation had betrayed, and that must sleep, shriek, struggle to escape as recollection of the drug decide, would think her son did she but see that shape, with 60 or more winters on its head, a compensation for the pang of his birth or the uncertainty of his setting forth. I referred to this when I was talking about John Wayne, the English critic 25 years ago, saying sturdily, I don't care what Yeats meant by that, what it means to me is a great deal more human and interesting than what he says he meant, because this is the passage on which in the collected poems Yeats has an elaborate note, particularly having to do with the phrase honey of generation in the second line, which sends you to Neoplatonic philosophy and passages of Porphyry and Plotinus. As Wayne, to my mind, very sympathetically says, if one doesn't have the note, or one doesn't notice that it is, one doesn't notice that it is there, or one is reading it in a selection like this where the note is not available, you can work it out, and it gives a very satisfying and indeed beautiful meaning in quite secular terms. Then it comes to mean, Yeats, of course, is now imagining how his own mother would regard if she could have survived to see him. What youthful mother, a shape upon her lap, honey of generation, had betrayed, and of a sleep, shriek, struggle to escape as recollection of the drug beside. The young mother, the newly born child, she, and in a sense the child who had been betrayed into the act of birth by honey of generation, and the phrase one gives to that is the sweetness of sexual encounter in which the child was conceived. And that must sleep, shriek, struggle to escape as recollection of the drug decide. Again, one can fit that to both the young mother and the baby as they struggle to consciousness immediately after childbirth and labour. And from then on, it is plain, what youthful mother in that situation would think the baby for which she went through all this at the point of his birth worth the candle if she could see what he became 60 years further on, battered and decrepit? Unfortunately, as I say, though that is the meaning one can work out, it is not the meaning that Yeats points to in his note. Then here we come to the last three stanzas, which Mrs. Garth understandably finds difficult. Plato and Aristotle and Pythagoras are invoked in stanza 6. He's, after all, asked a question there in stanza 5, one of the most difficult questions when you come to think about it, and a very human one. And he turns to three famous philosophers of the antique to give their answers, and then dismisses all three of them with old clothes upon old sticks to scare a bird. He's dismissing them, he's also dismissing himself. Really. He is an old scarecrow too. Now, each of these quatrains wittily and compactly gives a sort of witty epitome of the basic contentions of Plato's philosophy, of Aristotle's, and of Pythagoras. It would be it would take too long, and I hope it would be unnecessary to give a prose paraphrase of the couplet about Plato, for instance, which would involve us in a excursus on Plato's philosophy. I mean, the time isn't for that. Particularly witty, I think, is when we turn to Aristotle. Aristotle is solider than Plato. Well, yes, because Aristotle believed that the things we perceive have a degree of substantial reality and trustworthiness in themselves, whereas Plato regarded them always as illusory shadows of an ideal which they distortedly refer to. Played the tours upon the bottom of the King of Kings. Played the tours is a deliberately archaic expression. The tours, sometimes spelled T-A-U-S-E, is an old word for the cane, the bunch of birch with which the old-fashioned schoolmaster kept his pupils in order. And it has to do, apparently, with the fact that Aristotle was the chosen philosopher of Alexander the Great. Pythagoras, of course, is the name from the ancient world that stands for, and Gates, I guess, very interested in this, stands for the notion that ultimate reality can be expressed characteristically in mathematical proportions and most clearly thereafter in music, hence figured upon a fiddlestick or strings. Well, he invokes these celebrated answers that have been given to the puzzle of human life, the puzzle of why it is so brief, the puzzle of why it starts beautiful and the whole process of life is a gradual defacing of the near perfection that is at the moment of birth. And then 7, both nuns and mothers worship images. Well, that is admittedly a new departure again, but it really is a picking up of what has been talked about before we had this brief excursus into ancient philosophy. Nuns have been there in the poem from the beginning. They're part of the scene. It is an old nun who is moving around the classroom. Then he has moved through remembering what gone as a child to the thought of his own mother. And so it's natural enough to here compare that both nuns and mothers worship images. The mother has an image of what the child is going to be, both during the 9 months of gestation and while thereafter through its infancy. And that is an image which she worships, she is devoted to in a really self-sacrificing way, in the same way as the nun worships the image of Christ, the image of the Madonna, and devotes herself through self-denial to a life of service and devotion of those images too. However, he goes on, there is a difference between them. Those are the candles light, which are of course the images of the nuns worship, the sacred pictures, particularly in a church or an oratory. They're not like a mother's reveries. They are works of art, good or bad, hence they keep a marble or a bronze repose, and yet they too break hearts. Everybody knows that. Nothing is more common than for children to break their mother's hearts. He goes on to say that images of art can also break various hearts, perhaps the heart of the man who tries to emulate them, or who falls in love with them and can never find anything in flesh and blood to measure up to them. Oh, presences, he then breaks off, that passion, piety, or affection knows, and that all heavenly glories symbolize. Well, there we've had, the 3 words are all meant. Passion, for instance, the passion of love, the passion that he has felt, he remembers years ago from Maud Gonne. Piety, which is what the presence that the nuns know, and affection, which is the presence that the mother knows when she broods upon the child. Each of them create presences. That is, oddly enough, it's an unusual word for Yeats. It is, of course, very much a Wordsworthian word. It is that which is felt to of her child dwells so intently upon what he may be 10 or 20 years hence that it is that is impalpably present in the room as she meditates. In the same way, the religious, skilled in devotion to the image of, say, the Madonna, we must suppose, indeed there's plenty of evidence, he dwells so intently that he feels the Virgin there present. And in the same way, the lover's intent adoration, whether in her presence or her absence, of the loved one creates, and again we know all this from Romeo and Juliet, a presence beyond that of the specific human being. And these, all of them, symbolize the glory of heaven. That's to say, each of them is in itself misleading. Each of them, because they will betray, inevitably of their nature, will break hearts, or at any rate bruise them drastically. Nonetheless, they are, and here he is thinking platonically for the moment, symbols of reachings towards the glory which in fact does live in the heavenly sphere. And so they are self-born mockers of man's enterprise. Self-born is a very important word for Yeats at this time. It is difficult here. There is a sense in which one might, common sense might say that a painting of the Virgin is not self-born. It is born of a cooperation between Michelangelo, some canvas and some pigment. But I think it wouldn't be too difficult to sort of go beyond that commonsensical vision and to realize that there is a presence upon the canvas which comes upon the canvas from outside, from beyond the personality of Michelangelo, from beyond the tools of his trade and the circumstances of his activity. Then, this last stanza is one of the most beautiful and touching, I think, in the whole of Yeats. O self-born mockers of man's enterprise, he ends the previous stanza, and semicolon, so that what then is to follow is an expansion and elucidation of what has been packed into that single line. You will remember I made the point that one of the remarkable things about Yeats is that with him, punctuation and grammar continue to be sure guides for us as readers. Way that is not true of other modernist poets in English and in other languages. So, 8. Labour is blossoming or dancing where the body is not bruised to pleasure soul, nor beauty born out of its own despair, nor blear-eyed wisdom out of midnight oil. Well, where is that? I think the implication is very strongly, nowhere in this world. In this world, you refine the soul, you give pleasure to the soul by deliberate mortification of the flesh. The body is bruised to pleasure the soul. Our beauty, too, is born out of its own despair. The highest beauty is earned by our suffering. It is tragic beauty. Nor blear-eyed wisdom out of midnight oil. You grow wise at the same time as you get blear-eyed through hard study and contemplation. Thus, in this world, the whole process of life is, and here we go right back to the beginning of the poem, is a process of self-destruction, decrepitude, division, one part of the personality set over against another and defacing it, and that is what the process of aging through life means. This is not a difficult perception. It is what almost any adult must feel when he looks upon a child, a small child. Hence, he asserts that there is a place where labour doesn't turn upon itself and destroy its own vehicle, whether the labour of love or the labour of study or the labour of piety. There is a place, or there is a condition in which, on the contrary, labour blossoms and dances. There is such a thing, in other words, to put it into terms that might be more readily apprehensible, in terms, say, of English Romanticism or Coleridge and the Coleridgean tradition, there is a place in which form is indeed organic, in which you do not, in order to get the easy, beautiful poem, have to sweat for days, weeks, or months to get it, for instance, in which it just indeed does come as naturally as leaves to the tree, to quote another English romantic, Keats. Yeats asserts that that exists, that place exists, but it is what he calls heaven. It is not here. And this, it ends with this vision of this place where the self-division of human life is in fact healed. And he invokes that place. He said, blossoming or dancing, we can take up the blossoming. O chestnut tree, great-rooted blossomer, are you the leaf, the blossom, or the bough? Which is a rhetorical question. This is, of course, the image for a really totally organic, unified, and harmonious development of a personality, of a human body, of the artistic body that is a poem or a sculpture. All these things which we aim at in life but can never attain, the image for that which we attain, that really total organicism, is naturally enough, and it's not an original image, a tree. Are you the leaf, the blossom, or the bough? All of it is the tree. The tree is present in every one of its parts, even of the greatest poets. Though we get near to that condition, we can never say it. We can always say that this is the central theme, or this is one of the further ramifications, ramus, a branch, or this is the decorative surface. And then he takes up the other one, the dancer. O body swayed to music, O brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance? And there is another image of total unification between the artistic form, the dance, and the vehicle, the human body, which incorporates it. The book that I mentioned to you, Frank Kermode's Romantic Image, traces this image of the dancer, incidentally, all the way through Yeats' career, from, he points out that it is one of the images which he shared with, and presumably perhaps first took from the French symbolist poet, from Mallarmé, for whom, for instance, the daughter of Herod, Salome, who dances before Herod, as we know from the scriptures, in order to have the head of the martyred John the Baptist given to her on a plate, is a curious and immensely meaningful image for Mallarmé. And it is the sort of thing which Yeats too very much responded to. All right, Mrs. Cutts?
Still need to think, but thank you.
There's another dancer you will have noticed in a very extraordinary passage of 1919. I hope it's a poem you've read with great care, page 109 onwards. The second section is remarkable as one of the relatively few places, so there are others in this poem, where Yeats really does go into free verse and is unmetrical, so far as I can see. When Loy Fuller's Chinese dancers enwound a shining web, a floating ribbon of cloth, it seemed that a dragon of air had fallen among dancers, had whirled them round or hurried them off on its own furious path. So the platonic year whirls out new right and wrong, whirls in the old instead, all men are dancers and their tread goes to the barbarous clangor of a gong. Here the dancer is used in a very different sense, of course. Loy Fuller's The Chinese Dancing Troupe, she's historical, you can find it. And Yeats went to a performance, and apparently these Chinese dancers are danced with a long streamer of cloth which wound among them. Yeats, in an astonishing act of imagination, sees in that an image of the coiling, uncoiling, weaving and unweaving of human history, seen in a cyclical fashion, as he had learned to see it from Biko and as he had explained it in the at the end of a vision when he was talking about the great year, the Magnus Annus, as he calls it. And indeed he's quite specific. So the Platonic year was a new right and wrong wills in the old instead. So this is a quite different sense, a quite different use of the dancer image. Next section of the poem takes up another one that he's... By this time, you see, what happens, in a sense, to all ambitious poets who keep on with total sort of egocentric consistency throughout, despite the changes that occur, by this time, he has accumulated an enormous stock of images which are his, so that for those who have followed him through his career up to this point, the dancer, as he introduces it in the poem now in the 1920s, has all the incremental richnesses that it has had by being used in this poem and that poem for 30 or 40 years before. And the same is true of the swan, which we have seen so many times. So here, it comes in very, very casually. Some moralist or mythological poet compares a solitary soul to a swan. I am satisfied with that. But of course, this too goes all the way back to Mallarmé, and it's going to reach forward to Coulthard and Baladi, and to an even later. Yes, ma'am. A good question. No, I don't think so. These are beautiful little jeweled toys, like an Egyptian scarab, the beetle. I think it's plain. Many ingenious, lovely things are gone that seem sheer miracle to the multitude, protected from the circle of the moon that pitches common things about. This is the beginning of 1919. There stood, amid the ornamental bronze and stone, an ancient image made of olive wood. Gone are Phidias' famous ivories and all the golden grasshoppers and bees. It is, of course, this is the point of the date, the end of the First World War, in exhaustion and desolation all over Europe, the height of the murderous internecine squabble between Irish and English, as Yeats could already foresee, between Irishman and Irishman, and the destruction on all sides of what had seemed indestructible, the accumulated riches of European civilization. These are images of that. The famous sculptures of Phidias. And it goes on quite specifically. We too had many pretty toys when young. And then he specifies them that he says, a law indifferent to blame or praise, to bribe or threat. The rule of law, in fact, the real rule of law. We had that when young. This, we thought, was as good. This was as much of a toy that we made for our own delectation and thought of as permanent as are the little ivory carvings or golden carvings of scarabs and beetles and butterflies, the beautiful jewelry that is the bronze, ornamental bronze and stone. It's gone, 1919. We too had that. We had habits that made old wrong melt down as it were wax in the sun's rays. Public opinion ripening for so long we thought it would outlive all future.